Koppelheimer, the greatest storyteller in the world, sat back and beamed at the greatest minds in the world assembled at the dining table. Tepic had added another iota to his store of new knowledge. Symposium meant a knife and fork tea.
Well,
said Koppelheimer, and launched into the story of the Tussautian Wars.
You see, what happened was, he'd taken her back home and her father. This wasn't the old king, this was the one before, the one with the, what's-her-name. He married some girl from over El Harib way. She had a squint, what was her name now? Began with a P, or an L, one of them letters anyway. Her father owned an island out on the bay there. Papilos, I think it was. No, tell a lie, it was Krynix. Anyway, the king, the other king, he raised an army, and they, Eleanor, that was her name. She had a squint, you know, but quite attractive, they say. When I say married, I trust I do not have to spell it out for you. I mean, well, it was a bit unofficial. Anyway, there was this wooden horse, and after they'd got in... Did I tell you about this horse? It was a horse. Oh, I'm pretty sure it was a horse. Or maybe it was a chicken. Forget me own name next. It was what's-name's idea, the one with the limp. Yeah, the limp in his leg, I mean. Did I mention him? There'd been this fight. No, that was the other one, I think. Yes. Anyway, this wooden pig... Damn clever idea. They made it out of thing. Tip of my tongue, wood. But that was later, you know. The fight! Oh, nearly forgot the fight. Yes, damn good fight. Everyone banging on their shields and yelling. What's-name's armour shone like shining armour. Fight and a half, that fight. Between thingy, not the one with the limp, the other one. What's-name, had red hair, you know. You know, tall fellow, talked with a lisp. Hold on, just remembered. He was from some other island. No, not him, the other one with a limp. Didn't want to go. He said he was mad. Of course he was bloody mad, definitely. I mean, a wooden cow. Like what's-her-name said, the king... No, not that king, the other one. He saw the goat. He said, I fear the Ephebians, especially when they're mad enough to leave a bloody great wooden livestock on the doorstep. Talk about nerve, they must think we was born yesterday. Set fire to it. And of course... What's-name had nipped in round the back and put everyone to the sword. Talk about a laugh. Did I say she had a squint? They said she was pretty, but it takes all sorts. Yes, anyway, that's how it happened. Now, of course, What's-name, I think he was called Melicanus, had a limp. He wanted to go home. Well, you would. They'd been there for years. He wasn't getting any younger. That's why he dreamt up the thing about the wooden was-name. Yes, I tell a lie. Lavalius was the one with the knee. Pretty good fight, that fight. Take it from me. He lapsed into self-satisfied silence. Pretty good fight, he mumbled, and smiling faintly dropped off to sleep. Tepic was aware that his own mouth was hanging open. He shut it. Along the table, several of the diners were wiping their eyes.
Magic, said Zeno. Sheer magic. Every word a tassel on the canopy of time.
It's the way he remembers every tiny detail. Pin sharp, murmured Ibid.
Tepic looked down the length of the table and then nudged Zeno beside him.
Who is everyone? He said.
Well, Ibid you already know, and Koppelheimer. Over there, that's Iasope. The greatest teller of fables in the world. And then there's Antiphon, the greatest writer of comic plays in the world.
Where is Pythagonal? Said Tepic.
Zeno pointed to the far end of the table, where a glum-looking, heavy-drinking man was trying to determine the angle between two bread rolls.
I'll introduce you to him afterwards, he said.
Tepic looked round at the bald heads and long white beards, which seemed to be a badge of office. If you had a bald head and a long white beard, they seemed to indicate whatever lay between them must be bursting with wisdom. The only exception was Antiphon, who looked as though he was built of pork. They are great minds, he told himself. These are men who are trying to work out how the world fits together, not by magic, not by religion, but just by inserting their brains in whatever crack they can find and trying to lever it apart. Ibid rapped on the table for silence.
The tyrant has called for war on Tussaut, he said. Now, let us consider the place of war in the ideal republic, he said. We would require...
Excuse me, could you just pass me the salary? Said Iosope. Thank you.
The ideal republic, as I was just saying, based on the fundamental laws that govern...
And the salt. It's just by your elbow.
The fundamental laws, that is, which govern all men. Now, it is without doubt true that war...
No, could you stop that, please? It's celery, said Iosope, crunching cheerfully. You can't help it with celery.
Zeno peered suspiciously at what was on his fork.
Here, this is squid, he said. I didn't ask for squid. Who ordered squid?
Without doubt, repeated Ibid, raising his voice, without doubt, I put it to you.
I think this is the lamb couscous, said Antiphon.
Was yours the squid?
I asked for Merida and Dolmades.
I ordered the lamb. Just pass it along, will you?
I don't remember anyone asking for all this garlic bread, said Zeno.
Look, some of us are trying to float a philosophical concept here, said Ibid sarcastically. Don't let us interrupt you, will you?
Someone threw a breadstick at him. Tepic looked at what was on his fork. Seafood was unknown in the kingdom, and what was on his fork had too many valves and suckers to be reassuring. He lifted a boiled vine leaf with extreme care, and was sure he saw something scuttle behind an olive.
Ah, something else to remember, then. The Ephebians made wine out of anything they could put in a bucket, and ate anything that couldn't climb out of one.
He pushed the food around on his plate. Some of it pushed back. And philosophers didn't listen to one another, and they don't stick to the point. This probably is mockery at work. A bread roll bounced past him. Oh, and they get overexcited. He noticed a skinny little man sitting opposite him, chewing primly on some anonymous tentacle. Apart from Pythagonal, the geometrician, who was now gloomily calculating the radius of his plate, he was the only person not speaking his mind at the top of his voice. Sometimes he'd make little notes on a piece of parchment and slip it into his toga. Tepic leaned across. Further down the table, Iosope, encouraged by occasional olive stones and bread rolls, started a long fable about a fox, a turkey, a goose, and a wolf, who had a wager to see who could stay longest underwater with heavy weights tied to their feet.
"Excuse me," said Tepic, raising his voice above the din. "Who are you?"
The little man gave him a shy look. He had extremely large ears. In a certain light, he could have been mistaken for a very thin jug.
"I'm Endos," he said.
"Why aren't you philosophizing?"
Endos sliced a strange mollusk.
"I'm not a philosopher, actually," he said.
"Or a humorous playwright or something?" said Tepic.
"I'm afraid not. I'm a listener. Endos the listener, I'm known as."
"That's fascinating," said Tepic automatically. "What does that involve?"
"Listening."
"Just listening?"
"That's what they pay me for," said Endos. "Sometimes I nod, or smile, or nod and smile at the same time, encouragingly, you know, they like that."
Tepic felt he was called upon to comment at this point.
"Gosh," he said.
Endos gave him an encouraging nod and a smile that suggested that of all the things Endos could be doing in the world right at this minute, there was nothing so basically riveting as listening to Tepic. There was something about his ears. They appeared to be a vast, aural black hole, begging to be filled up with words. Tepic felt an overpowering urge to tell him all about his life and hopes and dreams.
"I bet," he said, "that they pay you an awful lot of money."
Endos gave him a heartening smile.
"Have you listened to Coppelheimer tell his story lots of times?"
Endos nodded and smiled, although there was a faint trace of pain right behind his eyes.
"I expect," said Tepic, "that your ears develop protective, rough surfaces after a while."
Endos nodded.
"Do go on," he urged.
Tepic glanced across at Pythagonal, who was moodily drawing right angles in his Taramasalata.
"I'd love to stay and listen to you listening to me all day," he said, "but there's a man over there I'd like to see."
"That's amazing," said Endos, making a short note and turning his attention to a conversation further along the table.
A philosopher had averred that although truth was beauty, beauty was not necessarily truth, and a fight was breaking out. Endos listened carefully. The role of listeners has never been fully appreciated. However, it is well known that most people don't listen. They use the time when someone else is speaking to think of what they're going to say next. True listeners have always been revered among oral cultures and prized for their rarity value. Bards and poets are ten a cow, but a good listener is hard to find. Or at least, hard to find twice. Tepic wandered along the table to where Pythagonal was sitting in unrelieved misery and currently peering suspiciously under the crust of a pie. Tepic looked over his shoulder. "I think I saw something moving in there," he said. Said the geometrician, taking a cork out of an amphora with his teeth.
"The mysterious young man in black from the Lost Kingdom."
"I was hoping you could help me find it again," said Tepic. "I heard that you have some very unusual ideas in Ifeeb."
"It had to happen," said Pythagonal.
He pulled a pair of dividers from the folds of his robe and measured the pie thoughtfully.
"Is it a constant, do you think? It's a depressing concept."
"Sorry?" said Tepic.
"The diameter divides into the circumference, you know. It ought to be 3 times. You'd think so, wouldn't you? But does it? No. 3.141 and lots of other figures. There's no end to the buggers. Do you know how pissed off that makes me?"
"I expect it makes you extremely pissed off," said Tepic politely.
"Right. It tells me that the creator used the wrong kind of circles. It's not even a proper number. I mean, 3.5 you could respect. Or 3.3, that'd look right."
He stared morosely at the pie. "Excuse me, you said something about it had to happen."
"What?" said Pythagonal from the depths of his gloom. "Pie," he added.
"What had to happen?" Tepic prompted.
"You can't mess with geometry, friend. Pyramids? Dangerous things. Asking for trouble, I mean."
Pythagonal reached unsteadily for his wine cup.
"How long did they think they could go on building bigger and bigger pyramids for? I mean, where do they think power comes from? I mean..."
He hiccuped.
"You've been in that place, haven't you? Ever noticed how slow it all seems to be?"
"Oh, yes," said Tepic flatly.
"That's because the time is sucked up, see? Pyramids. So they have to flare it off. Flare light, they call it. They think it looks pretty. It's their time they're burning off."
"All I know is the air feels as though it's been boiled in a sock," said Tepic, "and nothing actually changes even if it doesn't stay the same."
"Right," said Pythagonal. "The reason being it's past time. They use up past time over and over again. The pyramids take up all the new time. And if you don't let the pyramids flare, the power will build up."
He paused.
"I suppose," he went on, "that it'd escape along a what's-name, a fracture in space."
"I was there before the kingdom, went," said Tepic. "I thought I saw the big pyramid move."
"Oh, there you are, then. It's probably moved the dimensions around by 90 degrees,
said Pythagonal, with the assurance of the truly drunk. "You mean, so length is height and height is width?" Pythagonal shook an unsteady finger.
No, he said. "So that length is height and height is breadth and breadth is width and width is..."
He burped.
"Time. It's another dimension, see? 4 of the bastards. Time's one of them. 90 thingies to the other 3. Degrees is what I mean. Only it can't exist in this world like that, so the place had to sort of pop outside for a bit, see? Otherwise you'd have people getting older by walking sideways."
He looked sadly into the depths of his cup.
"And every birthday, you'd age another mile," he added.
Tepic looked at him aghast.
"That's time and space for you," Pythagonal went on. "You can twist them all over the place if you're not careful. 3.141. What sort of a number do you call that?"
"It sounds horrible," said Tepic.
"Damn right. Somewhere..."
Pythagonal was beginning to sway on his bench.
"Somewhere, someone built a universe with a decent, respectable value of...
He peered blearily at the table.
"Of pie. Not some damn number that never comes to an end. What kind of a number?"
I meant people getting older just by walking along.
I don't know, though. You could have a stroll back to where you were 18, or wander up and see what you were going to look like when you're 70. Travelling in width, though, that'd be the real trick.
Pythagonal smiled vacantly and then very slowly keeled over into his dinner, some of which moved out of the way. He was wrong. Nature abhors dimensional abnormalities and seals them neatly away so that they don't upset people. Nature, in fact, abhors a lot of things, including vacuums, ships called the Mary Celeste, and the chuck keys for electric drills.
Tepic became aware that the philosophic din around him had subsided a bit. He stared along the line until he spotted Ibid.
"It won't work," said Ibid. "The tyrant won't listen to us, nor will all the people. Anyway," he glanced at Antiphon, "we're not all of one mind on the subject."
"Damn Tassortians needed teaching a lesson," said Antiphon sternly. "Not room for two major powers on this continent. Damn bad sport. Anyway, just because we stole their queen, you full high spirits. Love will have its way."
Coppelimer woke up.
"You've got it wrong," he said mildly. "The Great War, that was because they stole our queen. What was her name now? Face that launched 1,000 camels began with A? Or a T? Or a..."
"Did they?"
shouted Antiphon.
"The bastards!"
I'm reasonably certain," said Coppelimer.
Tepic sagged and turned to Endos the listener. He was still eating his dinner with the air of one who was determined to preserve his digestion.
"Endos," the listener laid his knife and fork carefully on either side of his plate.
"Yes."
"They're really all mad, aren't they?" said Tepic wearily.
"That's extremely interesting," said Endos. "Do go on."
He reached shyly into his toga and brought forth a scrap of parchment, which he pushed gently towards Tepic.
"What's this?"
"My bill," said Endos. 5 minutes attentive listening. Most of my gentlemen have monthly accounts, but I understand you'll be leaving in the morning?"
Tepic gave up. He wandered away from the table and into the cold garden surrounding the citadel of Ephebe. White marble statues of ancient Ephebians, doing heroic things with no clothes on, protruded through the greenery, and here and there were statues of Ephebian gods. It was hard to tell the difference. Tepic knew that Dios had hard words to say about the Ephebians for having gods that looked just like people. If the gods looked just like everyone else, he used to say, how would people know how to treat them? Tepic had rather liked the idea. According to legend, the Ephebians' gods were just like humans, except that they used their godhood to get up to things humans didn't have the nerve to do. A favourite trick of Ephebian gods, he recalled, was turning into some animal in order to gain the favours of highly placed Ephebian women. And one of them had reputedly turned himself into a golden shower in pursuit of his intended. All this raised interesting questions about everyday nightlife in sophisticated Ephebe. He found Petracci sitting on the grass under a poplar tree, feeding the tortoise. He gave it a suspicious look in case it was a god trying it on. It did not look like a god. If it was a god, it was putting on an incredibly good act. She was feeding it a lettuce leaf.
"Dear little Petortus," she said, and then looked up. "Oh, it's you," she said flatly.
"You didn't miss much," said Tepic, sagging onto the grass. "They're a bunch of maniacs. When I left, they were smashing the plates."
"That's per traditional at the end of an Ephebian meal," said Petracci.
Tepic thought about this.
"Why not before?" he said.
"And then they probably dance to the sound of the bourzouki,"
Petracci added.
"I think it's a sort of dog."
Tepic sat with his head in his hands.
"I must say, you speak Ephebian well," he said.
"But thank you.
Just a trace of an accent, though."
"Languages is part of the patraining," she said. "And my grandmother told me that a patrace of foreign accent is more fascinating."
"We learned the same thing," said Tepic. "An assassin should always be slightly foreign, no matter where he is. I'm good at that part," he added bitterly.
She began to massage his neck.
"I went down to the harbour," she said. "There's those things like big rafts, you know, camels of the sea."
"Ships," said Tepic.
"And they go everywhere. We could go anywhere we want. The world is our thing with pearls in it, if we like."
Tepic told her about Pythagonal's theory. She didn't seem surprised.
like an old pond where no new water comes in, she observed. So everyone goes round and round in the same old puddle. All the time you live has been lived already. It must be like other people's bath water.
I'm going to go back. Her fingers stopped their skilled kneading of his muscles.
We could go anywhere, she repeated. We've got Petrades. We could sell that camel. You could show me that Ankh-Morpork place. It sounds interesting.
Tepic wondered what effect Ankh-Morpork would have on the girl. Then he wondered what effect she would have on the city. She was definitely flowering. Back in the Old Kingdom, she'd never apparently had any original thoughts beyond the choice of the next grape to peel. But since she was outside, she seemed to have changed. Her jaw hadn't changed, it was still quite small, and he had to admit, very pretty, but somehow it was more noticeable. She used to look at the ground when she spoke to him. She still didn't always look at him when she spoke to him, but now it was because she was thinking about something else. He found he kept wanting to say, politely, without stressing it in any way, just as a very gentle reminder that he was king. But he had a feeling that she'd say she hadn't heard, and would he please repeat it? And if she looked at him, he'd never be able to say it twice.
You could go, he said. You'd get on well. I could give you a few names and addresses.
And what would you do?
I dread to think what's going on back home, said Tepic. I ought to do something.
You can't. Why try? Even if you didn't want to be an assassin, there's lots of things you could do. And you said the man said it's not a place people could get into anymore. I hate pyramids.
Surely there's people there you care about.
Petrucci shrugged.
If they're dead, there's nothing I can do about it, she said. And if they're alive, there's nothing I can do about it. So I shan't.
Tepic stared at her in a species of horrified admiration. It was a beautiful summary of things as they were. He just couldn't bring himself to think that way. His body had been away for 7 years, but his blood had been in the kingdom for 1,000 times longer. Certainly he'd wanted to leave it behind. But that was the whole point. It would have been there. Even if he'd avoided it for the rest of his life, it would still have been a sort of anchor.
I feel so wretched about it, he repeated.
I'm sorry, that's all there is to it. Even to go back for 5 minutes just to say, well, that I'm not coming back, that'd be enough. It's probably all my fault.
But there isn't a way back. You'll just hang around, sadly, like those deposed kings you told me about. You know, with threadbare cloaks, and always begging for their food in a high-class way. There's nothing more useless than a king without a kingdom, you said. Just think about it.
They wandered through the sunset streets of the city and towards the harbour. All streets in the city led towards the harbour. Someone was just putting a torch to the lighthouse, which was one of the more than 7 wonders of the world, and had been built to a design by Pythagoras using the golden rule and the 5 aesthetic principles. Unfortunately, it had then been built in the wrong place, because putting it in the right place would have spoiled the look of the harbour. But it was generally agreed by mariners to be a very beautiful lighthouse, and something to look at while they were waiting to be towed off the rocks. The harbour below it was thronged with ships. Tepic and Petrucci picked their way past crates and bundles until they reached the long, curved guard wall, harbour calm on one side, choppy with waves on the other. Above them, the lighthouse flared and sparked. Those boats would be going to places he'd only ever heard of, he knew. The Ephebians were great traders. He could go back to Ankh and get his diploma, and then the world would indeed be the mollusk of his choice, and he had any amount of knives to open it with. Petrucci put her hand in his. And there'd be none of this marrying relatives business. The months in Djeli Baby already seemed like a dream, one of those circular dreams that you never quite seem able to shake off, and which make insomnia an attractive prospect. Whereas here was a future, unrolling in front of him like a carpet. What a chap needed at a time like this was a sign, some sort of book of instructions. The trouble with life was that you didn't get a chance to practice before doing it for real. You only...
God grief! It's Tepic, isn't it?
The voice was addressing him from ankle height. A head appeared over the stone of the jetty, quickly followed by its body. An extremely richly dressed body, one on which no expense had been spared in the way of gems, furs, silks and laces, provided that all of them, every single one, was black. It was Chidda.
"What's it doing now?" said Pataclusp.
His son poked his head cautiously over the ruins of a pillar and watched Hat, the vulture-headed god.
It's sniffing around, he said. I think it likes the statue. Honestly, Dad, why did you have to go and buy a thing like that?
It was in a job lot, said Patterclasp. Anyway, I thought it would be a popular line.
With who?
Well, he likes it.
Patterclasp 2B risked another squint at the angular monstrosity that was still hopping around the ruins.
Tell him he can have it if he goes away, he suggested. Tell him he can have it at cost.
Patterclasp winced. At a discount, he said. A special cut rate for our supernatural customers. He stared up at the sky. From their hiding place in the ruins of the construction camp, with the Great Pyramid still humming like a powerhouse behind them, they'd had an excellent view of the arrival of the gods. At first he'd viewed them with a certain amount of equanimity. Gods would be good customers. They always wanted temples and statues. He could deal directly, cut out the middleman. And then it had occurred to him that a god, when he was unhappy about the product, as it might be, maybe the plasterwork wasn't exactly as per spec, or perhaps a corner of the temple was a bit low on account of unexpected quicksand, a god didn't just come around demanding in a loud voice to see the manager. No, a god knew exactly where you were and got to the point. Also, gods were notoriously bad payers. So were humans, of course, but they didn't actually expect you to die before they settled the account. His gaze turned to his other son, a painted silhouette against the statue, his mouth a frozen O of astonishment, and Patterclasp reached a decision. "I've just about had it with pyramids," he said. "Remind me, lad, if we ever get out of here, no more pyramids. We've got set in our ways. Time to branch out, I reckon."
That's what I've been telling you for ages, Dad," said 2B. "I've told you a couple of decent aqueducts will make a tremendous..."
"Yes, yes, I remember," said Patterclasp. "Yes, aqueducts. All those arches and things. Fine, only I can't remember where you said you have to put the coffin in."
"Dad!"
"Don't mind me, lad. I think I'm going mad. I couldn't have seen a mummy and two men over there, carrying sledgehammers."